Welcome to On the Hunt, a Flutter podcast. I'm your host, Matt Carroll. I'm also the chief of the Flutter Bounty Hunters. Today, I'm joined by Josh Matthews, who is a developer for Bringing Fire, a set of modern tools for tabletop game masters. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Happy to have you. So I think the place to start is what it means to bring modern tools to tabletop game masters. Perhaps what constitutes tabletop games, what is a tabletop game master, and what kind of tools are you bringing to that world?
Sure. So for anyone who's not already into the hobby, I mean, probably the first thing most people would think about would be Dungeons & Dragons, right? That's the most recognizable game in the hobby. They just had a movie that was last year, the year before, recently, right? Huge brand recognition. But there's plenty of other stuff. Pathfinder's a direct competitor for D&D, and there's a lot more smaller indie games. So there's a huge variety of different games and systems that all fall under tabletop RPG. You know, pen and paper RPG is another thing you might hear referred to as. You know, people sit around a table, usually roll dice, you've got a character sheet. Traditionally, it's very analog. We're working on building modern digital tools to help game masters, specifically the people who write and run the games that everyone else plays in, to write their campaigns, organize the material they need to run them, and keep track of everything as the games go on and the story that they're telling evolves over time.
Okay, I did see that movie, the one with Chris Pine, right?
Yeah, I hadn't seen anything with Chris Pine for a while. I was like, where did I see him? Oh, God, Star Trek, like a decade
ago. That's right.
But yeah, no, I like the movie. But we're not here to talk about the movie, but it was good.
Right. So I will admit I don't have any direct exposure to those games myself. I've never played Dungeons & Dragons, so I did see the movie. I also recall that in Stranger Things, I think Dungeons & Dragons was a pretty big part of that plot as well, right?
That's another place that a lot of people who aren't actually into the hobby have heard about it, is it was a major, I guess it was a major plot point in Stranger Things. The kids in Stranger Things all played D&D and then used D&D terms to refer to the weird goings-on as part of the plot. So that's another major touch point. Another thing, another way people seem to get into it is through Critical Role, is a live stream that is run by the GM in that game is Matt Mercer, who's a voice actor. There's a bunch of other voice actors whose names I can't recall off the top of my head because I'm not a regular viewer because their streams are like 4 hours long. But they started streaming their Dungeons & Dragons game years ago. And I think when they premiered campaign two, so a totally new story after they've been running for a while, they might have like broken some records for concurrent viewers on Twitch. So lots of people watch their stream, and lots of people recommend it to their friends, even as people who don't play tabletop games, is like, hey, this is really interesting entertainment that I watch, and you should check it out. It's even farther now. I think they might have kickstarted it, but now there's now an animated series based on their first campaign that's on Amazon Prime Video that you can just watch. Now it's a TV show.
Yeah, so that's some great success. They're blowing up online streaming. They're branching out into television. Who knows where they're going to go next? I think one thing that would still help to level set here is, like, even though I have some vague awareness of what Dungeons and Dragons is like, one thing I've never been clear on is how much of it is improv, playing off each other in the moment, versus how much is pre-scripted, pre-written stuff you're bringing that's already set before you start.
Yeah, it depends a lot on the person. And that's part of what we're hoping to help with in certain situations with the tools we're building, but it depends a lot. So the way I started running games myself was with, I guess I should look over here where the camera is and not over here where I've got the video. Hang on, let me move this window. Make for a better stream if they're going on YouTube or something. Anyway, so what I did was I picked up a pre-written adventure or campaign that was put out by Wizards of the Coast. They're the ones who own the Dungeons and Dragons game. And on a pretty regular cadence, they'll put out new campaigns, and that has theoretically everything that you need. It's got a whole story, it's got it split into multiple parts, and it's maybe got some advice on how to onboard your players to the game and what their characters, how their characters might be connected to the story. I guess it's not everything. Usually you also want the monster manual if you're talking D&D, so sometimes it'll say, you know, this room has these monsters in it, and the monster names are bold, so you need to go look in the monster manual, and that's where you have all the mechanical bits to see, like, how much health do they have, and what can they, what are their attacks, and everything like that. So that's a common way to onboard, and in that case, like I said, you bought the campaign, you're being provided a lot of material that's already there, and it's already pre-written to a large extent. The campaign I bought was called Out of the Abyss, and I think it ran from levels 1 to 15. Level 20 is the maximum level in the D&D system, so that's a very long time. That's a lot of levels, but they've plotted out ahead of time, like, okay, your players start here, and they end here. And there's some level of variability with how they get from start to finish there, but there's a lot of assumptions made about, you know, well, they don't just go completely off the rails and travel to the other end of the continent or something, right? Like, they're kind of bought into telling this story and seeing where it goes. On the other end, there's a lot of DMs who will... Sorry, I'm going to use GM and DM interchangeably. GM is Game Master, DM is Dungeon Master. I think Dungeon Master, I'm not sure if it's trademark or copyrighted, but it's usually only used in relation to D&D, whereas Game Master is the non-denominational term.
Sure.
But there's other GMs who will go and write out what I've heard referred to as a world Bible. So they'll, you know, they've got this setting in their head. They write out a whole bunch of information about their custom setting that they want to tell a story in, and have that all written down. And, like, you know, if they were to print it out, it's going to be like a notebook like this thick before they get to the table, and have that to run for their players. Whereas there's others who will come in and just totally improv. Like, it is theory. I guess your original question is how much is improv versus how much is prep. And it depends a lot on the GM, I guess is the real answer. There's GMs who can come up to the table and, you know, from a very basic premise, like, you know, okay, you start in the tavern, to be cliched, they can improv an entire session from that. And you can buy a book and it's all written out ahead of time, at least to an extent. Realistically, a lot of it falls somewhere probably closer to the pre-written, at least in my experience. GMs and players, you know, have an idea of, like, here's the story we want to tell, in broad strokes. And then there's some amount of improv needed because you can't account for every possible action a human could take as they work with your story prompts. That's kind of one of the things that, at least for me, appeals to me about tabletop games as opposed to playing like a video game, is having a human being there handling your inputs essentially and coming up with what happens next. There's, in a way that, you know, can't be scripted ahead of time. There's not a limited set of outcomes.
Sure. So in a world where some amount of things come in the form of books that you're cross-referencing, there would seem to be some pretty obvious opportunities to work apps, phone apps, tablet apps into that space. What has that looked like over the last, let's call it, 10 years of the modern app era, and where do you guys come in with what you're building?
Right. Yeah, we should talk about the tech, I guess, and not just have me ramble about my favorite hobby. Yeah, no, absolutely. And the way I've been explaining the Bringing Fire and its mission to like friends and family who ask about it, you know, when I'm at Thanksgiving and I'm talking to, like, my grandma, and she's like, "Oh, what's that thing you're working on? What is it again?" Like, it's a productivity tool for this hobby. That is the extremely Cliff's Notes version.
Sure.
But yeah, so there's a couple of, I guess the biggest thing in the space in terms of, or there's development in the space for, like, digital tools is probably virtual tabletops, right? Going back to what I said before, usually, you know, you watch Stranger Things, you know, the kids are seated around a table, they've got pen and paper, there's a grid that they've drawn a map on in the middle of the table. Virtual tabletops at minimum provide a way to grab, you know, icons or tokens representing the miniatures and whatnot you would have there in real life, and kind of position them on a grid and drag them around. A lot of them provide more functionality than that, so they'll provide some sort of character sheet a lot of the time and some knowledge of the rule set for what you're playing. So if you're playing D&D or Pathfinder or a system that has the idea of a map with dimensions and, say, limits how far your character can move on any given turn, maybe they will not let you drag the token beyond that point on your turn, if they know about that. Or they'll at least show you how far you've moved it in feet or whatever the units for that system are, so you can do that yourself. There's actually a whole fun tangent about how you calculate diagonals on a grid in these games, because no one wants to be doing partial units, so different systems have different ways of handling diagonal movement on a grid, so a lot of stuff is non-Euclidean, but not... That's fun, but not super relevant here. But so there's a couple different VTT providers, and some of them also have licensed content from Wizards of the Coast or other major RPG publishers. So that's another...
And just to be clear, just to make sure we're all on the same page for a virtual tabletop, this is a literal table that has, what, a screen on the top of it?
You can do that. Not necessarily. So when I ran my most recent campaign with some friends, which were... we did it all through Roll20, which is probably the most popular virtual tabletop. It's just a website. You invite people, your players all make accounts. And as far as I know, all of us were just sitting in our residences on laptops or desktop computers with it open in a web browser. You can put it on a tabletop. There's people who will build a table with a flat screen TV embedded in it, or put a projector above it. Or a friend of mine actually, I think his father-in-law made it for him. He did the TV table, but it wasn't a whole table. It was like a box with a flat screen TV facing upwards, so he could move it around and put it on top of the table. And then if you put the tabletop UI there and scale it properly so that the grid is what you'd expect it to be if it were paper, you can do that, but most people don't. That's too much hardware. The real selling point, I think, for a lot of people is playing remotely. My last campaign, the group was scattered all over the East Coast. The only way we were able to play together was over the internet like that. And, you know, everyone has a web browser.
Right. Now, I'm curious, just because I happened to just finish hosting a Twitter space about Vision Pro and where people think it might go, I'm curious, do you think that might play a role in this space, being able to have essentially an augmented reality board that everyone's seeing and sharing from wherever they happen to be?
It's possible. There's definitely been a lot of interesting mock-ups from some people in the space showing, like, you know, someone, I think it was even before Vision Pro, I think this is when AR was a more, like, you hold up a tablet sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And it maps the dimensions of the room, but there have been a couple mock-ups and maybe even one or two people trying to implement, like, okay, you have an empty table and it AR projects the board with the map and little minis moving on it. From what I know of Apple Vision Pro, I think that's probably going to be like financially prohibitive to run a whole game like that.
Certainly for the near term, I've been rolling. Yeah. I've been rolling out this theory that the Vision Pro is really a kitchen sink of sensors, and what they're going to do is see which ones are actually used over the next year or two. Then they're going to tear everything else out, and they're going to have like $1,000 headset for all the normal iPhone buyers.
That would make a bit. I forget what the Vision Pro costs. I remember looking at it, being like,
$3,500 baseline.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. As much as like a tricked out MacBook Pro. Yep. Right. Anyway, but yeah, no, I think it could definitely be cool. Although there's also kind of this tension in the space. So I keep coming back to pen and paper, right? Like if I want to play a game in person with some people, you know, with some game gurus of mine, you know, we could just grab a stack of index cards and some markers and pencils and like have a game going. And there's certain systems that are targeted towards that. I think there's actually one called Index Card RPG, whose like design is philosophy is based around very minimal materials. But for some people, and myself included to an extent, like being able to play a game with minimal investment, not necessarily financial, but like in terms of like materials and time and how much prep work and stuff has to go into having this ready to go before you actually start playing is appealing. On the other hand, there's also people who buy, you know, Warhammer 40K levels of miniatures and paint them all and use those on the table,
right,
to represent everything. So there's a whole, you know, spectrum you can sit on for how fancy you want to make your games. But part of what we're trying to target with what we're working on at Breaking Fire is the GM is always going to have to have is always going to be telling a story, right? There's going to be some information there too that they want to keep track of. So we're trying to be as broad as possible in our offering here, where we're just focusing on based on what I said earlier, maybe not necessarily, but there's usually going to be some amount of prep work. You're going to write what the story is going to be, at least in broad strokes. You're going to have some idea of where each session is going to go. You know, what's going to happen in each 2 to 4 hour game session. And then there's going to be, based on what happens, you're going to have to kind of ingest what your players did back into that in order to plan where things go. You know, maybe you expected things to go a particular way in one session and things went completely crazy. And now, you know, this NPC that was previously important is now dead or captured. And, you know, or they defeated a major enemy before they were supposed to, or anything that you didn't account for. You'll have to reincorporate things that your players did during a session back into your prep work in order to prepare for the next one. So we're trying to focus on that write, prep, run sort of cycle that we've observed in the way GMs run these games. And that could work regardless of how the game is run. If it's being run with index cards and Sharpie markers, or if it's being run in AR or with, you know, a whole living room table full of terrain and miniatures that someone has decked out.
Sure. And so is Bringing Fire a single application, or is this a group of applications that do related things?
So here's the fun bit with it. Bringing Fire is just the name of the company. The single application we're working on right now, the working name is Campaign Composer,
okay.
Which I think is what we're going to stick with. We previously had a name, the Adventure IDE, which could have been abbreviated to AID, which I liked, but not everyone knows what an IDE is, so
that's
not
right.
Quite as widely applicable. So Campaign Composer is the application, and I think that does a good job of getting across what it's designed for. It's for composing your material for running your campaigns. Right now, it's just a desktop app. We're on a Flutter podcast right now, so obviously written in Flutter. And your Flutter podcast, so using Super Editor pretty heavily, based on what I said before, it involves a lot of writing, so we need a text editor, and specifically a rich text editor. One of the things that we're trying to do a bit differently is there's a decent number of writing tools and like productivity tools that are Markdown based, which I don't mind. I'm going to stereotype a bit, but you're a developer as well. I'm guessing you're okay with Markdown in a lot of situations. But
for sure,
very broad appeal, not everyone is going to be okay with Markdown if they haven't had exposure to it before. So much is coming from using Microsoft Word or Google Docs to keep track of their material, which is the vast majority of cases based on people we've talked to. And my co-founder Avery, I think he interviewed like 100 different GMs before we started building this. Most people are using some variant of a Word document. not a lot of people are using purpose-built tools for this. So we want to meet people where they're at, and that's going to be a WYSIWYG editor.
So you said it's a desktop app, though you mentioned earlier that you used a website as a virtual tabletop. Is there are there things holding you back from the web, or is desktop actually just a better market for this tool at this time?
So we're not, there's a reason we're targeting desktop, but there might be, I'd have to look into exactly all the packages we're using in Flutter right now. It's possible if I tried to run it on the web at the moment, there would be a couple of gaps to fill, which is a whole different discussion we could have about the state of Flutter and the Flutter ecosystem, and the reality of cross-platform frameworks. But the reason we're targeting a desktop app is because one of the things we want to support is offline play. If you go to Gen Con, is I think the largest gaming convention in North America, or many other gaming conventions, there will be tabletop games you can sign up for ahead of time and play in. It's gotten better, but you know, maybe cell and Wi-Fi service isn't the best in a convention center with crazy amounts of people going through it each day. So we don't want our app to be bound to having an internet connection to use it. We want to support the GM who wants to do pen and paper, you know, just a bunch of people sitting around the table, and but have a digital tool for organizing their material without having to worry about, well, what if the internet goes out? So we want local first support for that reason, and that means you know, a desktop app or iPad app or mobile app once we get into that. So it means something other than just a web app. And one of the other things we considered, since I'm sure some people will be thinking about PWAs based on the audience I assume this goes out to, by all means leave a comment talking about how I forgot about PWAs. It boosts engagement for Matt. But PWAs is one thing we looked at, and we just didn't think, it's a little odd. We don't think it can replace a desktop app just because of the user experience right now. You have to be running in, I think, some variant of Chrome. I run Firefox. It's not possible to install PWA. I don't think Safari has it by default. I could be wrong about that, but last I checked, Safari didn't offer PWA installation when you went to a website that had it. And we just think it would cause too much user confusion about, like, oh, I've installed this website.
Yeah.
What's that mean? How do I update it? It's kind of in an odd place right now. It's technically very interesting, but we think it would be confusing for users who want a local first experience.
Yeah, it's the reason that I shifted to Flutter was because it was kind of the first cross-platform or multi-platform UI toolkit that I felt actually delivered on the promise of being largely indiscernible from the quote native approach. And everything before it, there was always things that weren't quite right. And what you're describing with PWAs just feels like yet another example of this promise where, no, it's like an app, even though it's not quite an app. And then still, there's little things here and there that just feel wrong, and it takes you out of it, and it breeds confusion. And I've at least felt that from a UI perspective, Flutter has avoided the uncanny valley, but everything else I've ever tried, it has some of that uncanny valley.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're writing a PWA or like any web app for that matter, like you have to just commit to having your own, you know, visual identity, because if you try to imitate whatever the native UI looks like in that, you're gonna hit that uncanny valley, like you said. I'm not sure if Flutter hits that for me, honestly. So I like Flutter's pitch for being, you know, they talk about native performance all the time, right? Which for them means it compiles to native machine code,
right?
Which is great, right? Like, not having to run the code through an interpreter is a huge plus in my mind. for what we're doing right now, we're developing a desktop app, right? That's going to run right now. We're producing builds for Mac OS, Windows, and Linux. We're trying to target the Mac OS design language, using a modified version of the Mac OS UI package, that's available on pub.dev.
Yep, and that's by Groove and Chip. So shout out to Groove and Chip for making that.
But we haven't put any work into, like, we're not trying to imitate the Windows design language, right? So if you run the app on Windows, it looks exactly the same as on Mac OS. It's using this re-implementation of the Mac OS design language. I think that's fine because no one really follows the Windows design language. I'm not sure if you use a Windows computer, but
Not in a long time, and not like I last time I was on Windows was before it went to the Windows 8 route. Like it was more of like the XP Vista type of
that's
UI.
dead too. So what you're thinking, Windows 8 was at one point called Metro, where it's
Right.
squares
Yep.
everywhere.
That's
It's
right.
grids of squares. That's gone too. But they do have what I think is a nice looking design language called Fluent. No one cares, just because Microsoft has fumbled all these transitions from XP to Vista to Metro to this thing. Everyone just kind of implements their own th just does their own thing,
Right. Although
when they're writing a Windows app.
there is a Fluent UI package out there, right? On Pub.
Yeah, and it's really good, actually. I would have after you calling him out, I would go so far as to say that Fluent is better than the Mac OS UI package. It's more feature complete. It's got like multi-tab views that I think you can drag and reorder things. When I looked at it, it was just more feature complete. So after you were shouting out Groove and Chip, now I'm saying like someone else has a better thing. But we thought it was more important to match the Mac OS language just because Mac OS users probably have stronger opinions about that.
That's typically true.
Yes. But there's a bunch of places where, so if that package didn't exist, going back to what you said before about avoiding the uncanny valley, like you can get very smooth animations and transitions and all this stuff out of Flutter, but you're still left kind of implementing from scratch, trying to imitate the language of the platform, if that's what you're going for.
Yeah, that's very true. And I guess for me, what I meant was less about looking like the platform and more about, for example, any time that I've downloaded or installed a web-based mobile app, for some reason, there's always too much padding. The border radiuses are always too big. It's like no matter how much they try to make it a mobile web app, it just looks like a web app running on mobile.
Right. Yes. Okay. For mobile specifically, yeah, I think I'd be inclined to agree with you because I've used plenty of those before where it's just an app in a web view.
Yeah.
I think some of that might be down to, I think someone could make a very nice mobile app that's just a web view given a lot the effort, but I think a lot of the problem is like the framework, like it's just not designed for that. There's a whole bunch you have to do to make things that aren't meant to be selectable, unselectable, and make everything behave the way it should in a mobile app as opposed to a web page, whereas Flutter's built from the ground up with mobile apps in mind. So it just
Right.
does the right thing by default in most cases.
Yeah, so
I mean, that's
I get this. I mean, at least just based on my experience with Flutter, I get the sense that it is reasonably achievable to take Flutter to literally any platform, including web, and make it look and feel like, again, not necessarily Mac platform UI, but you can have a UI that looks like it really is meant to be a desktop application. Or a mobile or a web, and it feels right on Flutter. And yet, most of the time when the web goes to the other places, I'm still like, no, this you've put web in front of me. Now, I will give one caveat though. Spotify, I think, has done a good job of building an app that feels like a desktop app, even though I believe it's Electron, I believe it's essentially a glorified web view, but that's pretty rare.
It's last I checked, it was Electron. I remember this was years ago at this point, but I would agree with your statement based on the state of the app. The last time I checked, I remember looking at like my process list and seeing like where are all the Chrome processes? How many Chromes am I running right now? And Spotify was definitely one of them. That's a WebView last I checked. I'm not sure about their mobile app. I'm not sure if it's a WebView or if it's like React Native or something more
That's true.
exotic
Yeah, I
like
don't know about
that.
the mobile. I would actually kind of hope that mobile would be either quote native or a cross platform like React Native or Flutter, but I'm not sure. I don't know which it is.
Yeah, but last I checked, the desktop app was definitely Electron, and they do a good job. Discord is another one I call out a lot as being a good multi-platform app. It's also Electron on desktop. My friend group uses it for talking when we play games together, which is, well, both the games we're talking about and also video games. But that is kind of its target audience. We actually use it for in place of Slack for internal comms at Bringing Fire. I'm in some other like community Discord groups, but it's great. I have it on here. I have it on my Windows machine.
Yeah, I would agree that Discord, I forgot that that was Electron as well, and I would agree that they've done a good job of making that feel like a very high performance and real desktop app, so to speak. So I guess we should then discuss, so we talked about these different technologies. I guess it is worth asking the question, what brought you and Bringing Fire to Flutter? What sealed that deal for you? Why not React Native? Why not Electron? Why not these other options?
So originally part of the draw for Flutter, when we started using it, it was I think desktop support was in beta at the time. Like
So
it
probably
was in beta, I
2020
forget.
thereabout.
Yeah, something like that. So part of the draw there was we know we're gonna wanna have mobile apps and tablet apps and all this stuff. We're gonna wanna be on all the platforms, right? So this is one of the few tools that potentially could let us have a single code base for targeting every single platform. I looked into doing Electron initially, and this is a bit of an aside, but also the onboarding experience for Flutter versus Electron is night and day. Electron is so bad to get started with. I'm sure once you know it's fine. There's a handful of like NPM, starter templates and stuff people have, but figuring out like going in from zero was overwhelming, whereas Flutter you can just kind of, Flutter create and it creates a template app and it's very easy to get started. That's not everything, obviously, but it is worth calling out that the Flutter team's done a good job with the developer experience and especially the onboarding. But for doing a web-based app or like a web view-based app, because we want a local application, there's a couple options. So obviously Electron's what you would do by default for desktop, and there's a couple different ways to embed it for mobile. So I was looking into how could we have a single code base that is just the UI of the app that's written in, React or Vue or whatever, and then it communicates with Electron or what's it called? Cordova is one of the ones for
That's
embedding on mobile.
one of them, yeah.
And we'd need some logic to figure out, which environment the UI is running in. And it was just going to be too much. And there, like I said, Flutter is the only one that really offered that we thought had the potential to deliver on this single code base, every single platform promise. Tori is another interesting one that maybe we would look into more closely if we were starting right now. Tauri, it's a Rust-based Electron competitor, effectively, where its thing is one, the back end, not really back end, I guess the embedder, is what I would call it, is written in Rust, and you write your code for it in Rust, and then instead of using Chrome, it uses the whatever WebView is native to the platform. So it uses WK WebView on Apple. It uses WebView 2, which is Chrome-based, but ships with the OS on Windows.
So if it's
whatever the GTK thing,
if it's displaying a web view again, does that mean that you're writing Rust code that eventually executes as JavaScript, or what's the connection between the Rust code and the web view?
So I haven't used it extensively. So, you know, all of this is my understanding of the docs I read a little while ago. So, you know, if anyone is listening to this, go read the docs for yourself. I'm not an authority on this at
send
all.
Send hate mail directly to Josh Matthews at this address.
Yeah. The so what it is the embedder. If you're writing stuff that runs in the embedder, which is not the UI, it's just the Rust process behind that, you write Rust. You probably write JavaScript for the UI. It creates a web view, and then it has, as part of its like standard library and as part of its build process, it provides a bridge for communicating between the JavaScript between JavaScript and Rust. You can write Rust for the UI. I know it's possible to write web-based UIs in Rust using compilation to JavaScript or compilation to WASM, but I don't think that would probably be the default. I think probably,
I don't even want to know what the verbosity would look like to use a systems level language to develop a UI anyway. It sounds on the face of it pretty darn painful.
There's people working on Rust like UI toolkits, and maybe something cool will come out of it. A lot of them are early stage right now. I like Rust, so I look in on it every so often. There's cool stuff. People are doing like crazy macros to represent, you know, effectively what the widget tree would be in Flutter. But yeah, I wouldn't go that route. I would write React or Vue and then use that bridge that they provide to communicate with the embedder.
Yeah, and I will, to that point about macros, I have a pretty strong opinion about the nature of composing UIs, because I think my concern about those macros is the same concern I have about Swift UI, which is that in Flutter, I really appreciate the fact that I am composing widgets around widgets. So I always know what the actual tree looks like, because literally the tree is the code and the code is the tree. Whereas macros, it's generating something. So unless you go in and look at the macro code, you don't know what it's generating. And similarly in Swift UI, they have this pretty builder pattern, which I agree on the face of it is a pretty way to compose things. But the nature of a builder is that it is executing imperative code in between. So once again, you're not quite sure what that final tree looks like. You have to go inspect things to find out.
Yeah, that was, I remember when, so one, we briefly tried looking into Swift UI for, if we want to write all native apps initially, which, you know, given infinite time and resources, right? If we want to be like, okay, this is going to be the best possible experience on every single platform, given infinite time and resources, I think the right thing to do would be to write a native app for Mac, Windows, web, iOS, Android, iPadOS, because it's a different, like, but we don't, those are not the constraints or lack of constraints we're working under.
That's right.
But yeah, so we looked into SwiftUI. I actually found it super confusing. I think maybe I'm in a weird headspace for like what the builder pattern. You're talking about like in SwiftUI.
They call them modifier methods, but it's visually the programming style is that of a builder pattern. So you'll say text dot font size 12 dot color green, and you chain these methods
right
together.
Yep. Okay. I was thinking of something even slightly different where I don't think it's called build, but like the equivalent in Swift UI to the build method in Flutter. It's not actually like Swift UI code. It's this sort of meta language in Swift that then produces different results. Do you know what I'm talking about? I sound
so there.
Crazy.
Yeah, well, we're probably two undereducated people talking about how Swift UI works, but there is. So when the equivalent of the build function, I think, tends to be called body. And it's actually, I think, declared as a getter or whatever, an accessor method. I'm not deep enough on the Swift UI grammar to know what is typical. Or sorry, not Swift UI, but the Swift grammar to know what's Swift and what's not. But there is this the use of curly braces and what you're allowed to put in there somewhat randomly, I do find to be confusing and non-deterministic.
Yeah. That's what confused me, where like you've got curly braces and then a list of like the
They don't have a children property. There's no children property in Swift UI. It's just stuff inside of other stuff.
Right. Well, a lot of the places where you have curly braces and it's just like, you know, view one, view two, view three, I was like, wait, this isn't returning anything, even though curly braces are lambdas. What is happening? And it's actually this like macro-ish thing that Swift has where you can take a block like that, and then there's logic you can implement to say, okay, so like it's almost looking at the AST and saying, okay, I see a declaration here. Because I see a declaration, I will do this thing that you have that the library has written, and then that is basically a builder. Except instead of saying, you know, builder.addthing.addthing.addthing, you just write them out in curly braces, and then there's other code in the background that knows how to do the builder stuff. So I was confused by that, because I'm like, this is like, these are just statements that aren't getting assigned anywhere. How is it ending up in the tree at the end? And it's because of that macro language.
Right. And there are a lot of Flutter developers. I mean, it doesn't help that Tim Sneath is now someone who's promoting Swift UI, but there are a lot of Flutter developers who look at that and they're like, oh man, no semicolons and no child properties and this and that. I'm like, listen, I understand that in the superficial case, it's really tempting to jump on that wonderful magical concision, but wait until you have to do something really complicated and you're going to realize there's this invisible magic standing between the beginner stuff and the expert stuff, and good luck crossing that chasm. I'll take the verbosity over that chasm.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, talking about invisible magic with Swift UI, is that if you go deep enough down in Swift UI and you try, like, if you're trying to do something that they don't support, eventually it's just UIKit.
Yes.
Like,
been there, done that, yep.
Including a rich text editor. if you want to do rich text editing in Swift UI, you just have to embed a UI text view, whatever it is, the rich text editor. For iOS, but it's just UIKit. You need to write the Swift UI view that bridges Swift UI logic to UIKit logic, and you need to know UIKit too if you're trying to do something complex enough.
Exactly.
I started on this from no mobile development experience, so to be like, okay, Swift UI is the new thing. Great, you know, hot new framework. I've done a bit of React before, so I'm familiar with that sort of paradigm. All right, how do I do a text editor? Oh, now I need to know UIKit. I need to understand UIKit and Swift UI well enough to know how to like manage this interface layer between the two. That was terrible. I think Swift UI will be great when it's done.
No, if it ever quite gets there, because they probably will never be divorced from some level of backwards compatibility expectations, which is really why UIKit, I think, is in there. It's like the whole world has been UIKit for 30 years in various ways. And so they can't just eliminate that. Instead, they have to just offer a modality on top of it or around it or something. So I don't know if they're ever going to truly be able to get rid of that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Apple, more so than Microsoft, at least, is like willing to kill legacy APIs and like actually deprecate stuff and then remove it. But all of UIKit, yeah, I don't know. I think I would like to be able to do everything in Swift UI without having to drill down into UIKit, I think, is what I will say.
I bet if you chase any Swift UI view deep enough, even something as simple as just like plain text, I bet you that's still a UIKit view. I bet that UIKit is essentially the render objects of Swift UI. I bet is how that's implemented.
That certainly is what happens. Like when you know, you as not a random person trying to develop on Apple need to do something complex, that's what ends up realistically happening. I think I looked into it and I saw claims from on like Apple developer forums saying like, oh no, like they've actually re-implemented stuff in Swift UI instead of just embedding UIKit. But I'll bet like that was probably the first implementation, and they're, you know, for things that need certain performance improvements, or depending on how complex it is, they will either have rewritten in Swift UI or just embedding UIKit in being done with it. The other, oh yeah, I don't want to lose it. That when we were trying to do, we were playing with SwiftUI for a bit, I had to file a sonar bug. You were talking about like the the builder pattern before, where it's like text.bold.fontsize.whatever. So we were hoping to be able to target iPad and Mac OS. So we were going to do Catalyst.
Okay.
Also, now there's this weird overlapping Venn diagram of different ways on Apple to do support for different platforms, right? Because you've got AppKit, which is the Mac OS equivalent to UIKit, I suppose. UIKit, which is for iOS. Then there's SwiftUI, which compiles and runs on both. Unless, as I said before, you need to... So it compiles and runs on both if you're only using SwiftUI.
Right.
Then there's Catalyst, which lets you compile UIKit to run on macOS. Great. So if you're writing SwiftUI with UIKit under the hood for complex stuff that hasn't been ported to SwiftUI yet, you can write SwiftUI and compile it with Catalyst.
Does Catalyst, for example, convert... touch targets that are broader, bigger touch targets, does that become more precise with the mouse on desktop, or is it just literally run the same code, same behaviors?
I think there's two ways to do it. There's like, when you go to create it, you can say, oh, is this an existing iPad app that I just want to run on a Mac screen, or do I want it to be more adaptive between the two platforms? It's been a long time since I touched it, so I don't want to speak more definitively than that. I know there's two modes. There's like quick and easy from iPad to Mac mode, and the more high touch, higher quality mode that you can run Catalyst in. But I was trying to do like a modifier on a drop down button or something, and I found out that when compiled with Catalyst, with this particular like hierarchy of builder modifiers, the button just didn't work. It just didn't respond, and when I removed one of those builder parameters, it worked. But it worked fine if I wasn't compiling with Catalyst and just SwiftUI, but if it was Catalyst plus SwiftUI, it was busted with that particular argument. I forget the specifics, it was a while ago, but I filed a sonar bug and never heard anything after that.
Yeah.
But that's
that tends to happen with a lot of sonar bugs. Or really, anytime I look up an Apple support anything, someone asks a question, then checked in a week later, then a month later, and then there's just no answer from Apple.
Yeah, I mean, I filed the bug. Whatever. I filed the bug and
well, so
done.
You want to know how hard multi-platform is. Apple can't even do it well on their own platforms.
On their own, right. Yeah, I think there was, I think it was the music app. One of the, like, I think it was music or podcast, but years ago, they like relaunched, they split iTunes up, right? Now it's music and podcasts and whatever. And at least one of those was a Catalyst app, and it was like terrible. It was like not a good pitch for using Catalyst as the new, everything UI toolkit for the Apple ecosystem. Okay, I should stop ragging on stuff I'm not using right now.
So clearly though, you looked at a lot of these different options and technologies, and you found your way to Flutter. It was this kind of eventual bet that you want to go mobile as well as desktop, and that seemed like probably the best option at the time.
Have as much of a shared code base as possible, because we do not have infinite resources as much as I would like to. Also, not to, you know, now to plug your thing with like 8 minutes left, Super Editor coming out was actually a big part of that. So when we were looking into native, I was actually looking to do, we could maybe do native apps, but for the rich text editor, just do a web view for that, because a lot of the innovation in the rich text editing open source scene is in JavaScript. And I think it's for an obvious reason, which is that rendering text is hard and HTML does it for you. So I don't know if you've seen like the dirty hack for getting a rich text editor in HTML is you just have you have a tag with content editable, and then now the user can
edit and that's
the rendered HTML.
And that kind of goes back to what you're saying about UIKit as well. which is, I mean, on the one hand, you get something right out of the box with one line of code. On the other hand, if that's not really what you want, if you want to modify it, you're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, and UI text field, like the rich text editor for UIKit, it gets I found a blog post entirely talking about how hard it is to make hitting enter in a bulleted list create a new bullet point properly. But so we were considering just using probably Prose Mirror, which is actually a pretty nice looking rich text editor toolkit for JavaScript, just because like all the platforms have a rich text editor library within them somewhere, but they're vastly different, and they're very complex to use, at least relative to anything in the like the JavaScript ecosystem, where the renderer is given to you for free in the form of the HTML, in the form of rendering HTML. But looking into Flutter having Super Editor come out, and it'd be just, okay, so you can have a rich text editor, and the thing that it renders is just Flutter widgets under the hood. I've been using Super Editor basically since you guys announced it, I think, and there's a fair bit more complexity to it than that, but the fact that the end result is a Flutter widget that ends up in the tree and just gets rendered makes it a lot easier to deal with than any of these other much lower level rich text editing APIs that I saw in like UIKit and whatever Microsoft's calling their current thing. I think it's called WinUI is the thing, is like their current UI toolkit. We could have a whole other discussion about Microsoft abandoning their previous UI toolkit to move to the next thing before it's even done.
Yeah, no surprise there. But yeah, to your point, it is, I think it's a big testament to the power of Flutter's widget abstraction that nearly everything in Super Editor is just a careful composition of widgets. Now, obviously, the representation of a document and altering that document, that's an independent concern that's separate from the widget tree. But what you see in that document editor are image widgets and text widgets, and a bulleted list is just a row with a little dot followed by a text widget. And again, I think that speaks to the power of the widget system. I wish the Flutter team would be more responsive when we show up and say, here's something we're attempting to do, and render paragraph won't do it. But that's a different problem than the question of whether or not widgets are very powerful as an abstraction.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I had a similar experience recently, actually, where we wanted to develop we're working on a search UI, and we want to show if the search term appears in the middle of text. What we want to do is, so imagine, you know, there's a run of text which with your search term in it as a substring. We want to bold every instance of the search term, and then position the text such that the first occurrence appears, you know, a little bit offset from the left-hand side of the viewport. And then truncate with ellipses at the start and end of the string so that it fits in that area. As far as I can tell, there's no way to do that just with text. The text widget truncates at the end or at the beginning, but you can't say position it in the middle here and truncate on both sides. So we had to use like the render text. We had to write a custom render object, right? Like we have to do a speculative pass, figure out based on the font and everything where it needs to lay out, and then position it properly and do the truncation ourselves and all this stuff. And there's a lot of logic that's already in the text widget and or the render paragraph. Is render paragraph a widget or a render object?
It's a render object. And the text widget is what is the widget that accesses the render paragraph.
Yes, there was some logic in there that I remember having to copy out because it's like in private methods and stuff in there, and it just didn't work for us.
Of course it's in private methods.
Yeah, and that's kind of a problem. I don't know if I'd say it's a problem with Flutter, but it's like a problem with the current state of the Flutter documentation and community, where like once you go below the widget layer, if you have to start messing with render objects and things farther down the stack, you can like... The documentation is still pretty good, and it's open source. You can always just dig into it, but that is kind of where the community knowledge starts getting less and less once you're doing very low level things.
Right.
Anything below the widget tree.
And I would also say, that even though the team supposedly has this principle of embracing aggressive composition, because render objects are so rarely used by the community, it's easy for them to ignore their own principles there, which is why, for example, render paragraph and render editable are these massive monoliths that you can't compose, and they hold everything, and it's private. So like you said, you got to copy the whole darn thing. And so I wish they followed their principles more at the render object level. But I do see that we're close to running on time. So for those tabletop gamers out there who would like to try what you're building, where might they find it?
So they can go to bringingfire.com. That's just bringingfire, one word, no hyphens, no underscores, no nothing. And you can find their information about what we're doing. So obviously talking about Campaign Composer, it's the app we're developing. It's in a sort of semi-closed alpha right now. So if you click the Try Campaign Composer button, there will be like a questionnaire, try to get an idea of what sort of user you are. And then eventually you can get to a download. We are also working on running those workshops that I very briefly mentioned earlier. We call them, the one we've run so far is called GM101. We ran it at Gen Con last year. We're going to run it at Gen Con this year. It's gotten pretty good reviews from the participants. So if you're going to be at one of these conventions we're going to be at, and you are interested in running your own tabletop games, but you don't know where to start, or you've got some, stage fright about being the game master or anything like that, that's what this is there to address. See about, if you're going to be there, maybe think about signing up. And even if you don't want to download the composer, we have some videos showing the functionality, including what we've built with Super Editor. So you can find that on the website as well if you just kind of want to see what we're doing. Oh, and the Discord. We have a Discord. Join it.
All right, great. So go to bringingfire.com. Also join the Discord. Give tabletop gaming a try. Josh, thank you very much for being here today. I also want to thank Bringing Fire for helping to fund Super Editor. And I appreciate all of you in the audience for joining us today. We'll see you next time on The Hunt.